to the memory of Bhante Sangharajita, in gratitude for everything she's done for us. Not only would I not be here now giving this talk, but it's sobering also to think that Sangha and I wouldn't exist, this centre wouldn't exist, all the relationships that form within this centre, and indeed in all the centres around the world, would not exist were it not for dear Bhante Sangharajita. So thank you, Bhante. I'd like to also give a personal warm welcome to Sri Raja. As Manikosha said, we've just recently come back from an ordination course together, so it's lovely to see you here tonight. It struck me recently that when we come through the door into the Buddhist Centre, we go through a door, we pass through a gateway, we cross a threshold, and we leave one space and we go into another space. And the new space that we come to is substantially different from the space we've just left. There's a different atmosphere. We can feel perhaps a certain calm as we walk through the door, a certain energy, whether there's people here or not. And when we come again through this door, the door into the shrine room, we leave one space and we come into another space. And the atmosphere is substantially different. For example, there may be a lingering scent of incense. We may feel ourselves in the presence of the Buddha. Or we may feel the sense of common purpose that we have with others as we sit here together. So, we leave one space, we go through a door, and we enter another space. And we can think of meditation as that. We leave the space which is our ordinary everyday lives. We pass through some sort of gateway, which I'll talk about in a moment. And we enter the space which is meditation. And that's what I'd like to talk to about tonight, is the space which is meditation. And when we go through that space, go through the gateway, come into that space, the rules are different. We enter a different reality, we enter in a different realm. We leave, into some sense, something behind. And in that sense, we're leaning away from something and leaning towards something else. And that's a metaphor that's often used in the spiritual life. We lean away from our past life and lean forward to something else. And we talk in terms of going forth. So we can think of meditation as a going forth, but going forth from our everyday life into something else. And where do we go to? Well, basically, we go for refuge. We go for refuge to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, when we meditate. And we can think of meditation as a moment by moment going for refuge. Others have passed through the gateway, others have passed through the door before us, they've shown us the way. All we have to do is take up the invitation and follow. And with every going through a gateway, there's a transition involved. And that transition is important because what we're doing is going into somewhere which is itself a gateway, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But often we mark the passing through into another space in some sort of way, in the same way that often we ring a bell when we go through a door. We also can ring a bell to mark our going into meditation. At home we've often got a special place to mark something special about meditation. We have a special shrine space maybe, and we go there because we're doing something special. Sometimes we may take up mala beads to hold, again, to mark in what we're doing. It's something a bit out of the ordinary, something a bit extraordinary. And recently I've taken to wear my ordination robes when I meditate, again, just to say to myself, what I'm doing is something special. And I think that in the same way that an athlete, like Usain Bolt's probably a bit out of date now, but let's use his example, wouldn't just get off the team bus and start running 100 metres, he'd prepare first of all. Nor would a concert pianist just get straight out of bed and start playing the works of Chopin, although Akasha Deva is busy and might be able to do that. But most of us can. We need to prepare in some sort of way. And on the ordination retreat that we were on, we were asked as far as we could For each meditation, whether it was a concentrated meditation like the mindfulness of breathing, a generative meditation like the Metta Bhavana, a reflective meditation like the six element practice, or a meditation where we're just sitting, whatever type of meditation is, we're encouraged to get in touch with four things. First in touch is getting in touch with ourselves. Rag Negoshi showed us earlier how we can do that, get in touch with our body, which may involve doing a body scan. It might just be going through our body just to find out and to use our body as part of that threshold that we're going through. We also then get in touch with our mind. What's happening in our mind today? Is it a busy mind? Is it a calm mind? What's happening today? And also without any emotions, any particular emotions that are going, are we happy, are we sad, are we resentful, whatever it is. So we get in touch with ourselves just to see how we are today. Secondly, we get in touch with meditation, mindfulness, and metta bhavana. Whatever the meditation is, it's a good idea just to get in touch with metta, get in touch with mindfulness, in whichever way we do that. Thirdly, we get in touch with our commitment to meditating, which may just be turning up. The fact that we turn up is itself a commitment, and for some of us it can be quite a big thing. But for most of us, the commitment is rather bigger than that, and we can think of it in terms of a commitment to going for refuge to the three jewels. We make a decision, we make a resolution, that this is what we want to do. It's not just something we enter into casually. We also make a resolution, we make a decision, we make a commitment perhaps not to be affected as far as we can by the hindrances. And so what we're doing is, by preparing ourselves in this way for meditation, is we're setting up the right conditions. And of course this is a reflection of the fundamental Buddhist insight that nothing happens in isolation. We set up the conditions so that as far as possible we try and put in the conditions that will make the meditation effective. The Santaras use the phrase going into neutral. I'm not sure what that really means, actually, going into neutral, but there's something about it which I really like. You go into neutral in preparation for your meditation. It's like you sort of get out of gear, and there's some sort of freedom, there's some sort of give and take somewhere when you're not in gear, you're in neutral. And that seems to work for me somehow. And then we don't push ourselves into the meditation space. Hopefully we're drawn in. We find something that wants to take us into this space. And first of all, we may enter into the body, and the first thing we may experience is stillness. And I remember talking to Surata at Padmaloka once about the idea of the dhyanas and whether he found the concept of dhyanas useful. And in his Surata way, he said, "Oh, I don't bother about all that. I set up stillness and the rest takes care of itself." I find it useful anyway to get in touch with that stillness at the beginning of meditation. And then there's the actual spaciousness of the space itself, where we can open up. And often when I do a metta bhavana, I think of my chest opening. And you know, when you think of your chest opening, you think of your heart opening. And you can often use that sort of metaphor or that image of a blossom opening up. And of course the archetypal Buddhist blossom or flower is the lotus. And that image of a lotus opening, I think, is an image which can also be taken to be an opening of our consciousness as well as our heart, that we're opening up into something which is substantially different. We're going into something which is beyond the mundane. And the space that we go into when we meditate is a very special space. I'd like to call it a sacred space, and I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. And it's special because we go through a gateway, as I've explained, into meditation, and that space is itself a gateway. It's a gateway into a different way of seeing and experiencing things. It's going beyond our normal waking space. It's fundamentally different, and we can even start to use the word transcend. It's a space where we can begin to transcend our normal everyday life, our normal everyday being. And I like the word sacred, but I know it doesn't always click with everybody. Some people find the word sacred difficult. And so I went to a dictionary and looked at, well, what does sacred actually mean? And I came up with a definition, connected with religion. I didn't find that very helpful, to be honest. Made holy by religion. Not really. So I looked up some synonyms. And I came up with blessed, devotional, hallowed, reverential, dignified, sublime, lofty, elevated, ennobling, I like that one, ennobling, supermundane, a solemn engagement, and therefore a sacrament, a solemn engagement, liberating, enchanted, magic. And some of those words have helped me to think of what I mean by a sacred space. It's something that's very special we go into. And I think by thinking about it in those terms, one can have more respect and more reverence for meditation. We can think of it as not something we do lightly, not something we do casually, but something we can take perhaps with solemnity. And I think that can help us when, as it does with all of us, we get into a habit, which is not necessarily good to have it, where we just get a routine and think, okay, I'll sit down and meditate and do it. And by looking at it as something that we can respect and revere, it can help, I think, to protect our practice, to deepen our practice, to brighten our practice, to bring it more alive. And this is particularly so when we are plateauing in our meditation, which often we are, when we get stuck. By putting the idea of meditation into a wider context, we can help to think of it that this, when we sit down to meditate, we're doing something which puts us in touch with something that transcends ourselves. Satya Pawar called her meditation sessions that she does on a Saturday the alchemy of meditation. I don't know, maybe other people have used that word before, and I like that idea of the alchemy of meditation is something transformational. I like the idea of a crucible where the dross of the mundane, the dross of the everyday, our petty aversions and our petty cravings are transformed into something golden, something brilliant, something shining, like a shining sun. And, you know, an example of that is time. You know, time in meditation is substantially different. Sometimes time seems to slow down totally, and sometimes time doesn't seem to exist at all. And Ranagosha talked about samadhi as being one of the five spiritual faculties, and that's what we're talking about tonight. And often the translation, and I'm using meditation as a translation for samadhi, but often the translation for samadhi is concentration. I prefer the word absorption to concentration, actually. And I can think of artists who are totally absorbed in what they're doing. I can think of athletes, you know, really, really focused in what they're doing. When we listen to music, we can be totally absorbed in what we do. And when we are like that, when we are absorbed in something, we're wholeheartedly dedicated to one thing. There's a sort of one-pointedness about us. There's a sort of unification of all our energies which go into that one thing. And it's almost like we're surrendering ourselves to something. It's almost in that sense when you're absorbing something, you're surrendering yourself to something. You're giving up yourself to something. You're devoting yourself to something. And it's interesting, I mean, when we talk about the devotional activities that we do as a Buddhist, we tend to think of pujas. But I can, you know, I also think that we can think of meditation as a devotion activity, an activity where we devote ourselves, we give ourselves over to an activity. And we can also think of it as something devotional in the terms that we can give up our meditation to someone. We can devote or dedicate our meditation to the Buddha, to an archetypal figure, to Bhante, to all living beings. And again, I think that if we do that, we can again get a sense of this is something sacred, this is something special that's going on here. We've probably all heard the phrase, treat your body like a temple. Well, if you can treat your body like a temple, you should be able to treat your mind like a temple, I think. And particularly treat meditation as a temple. Temple, which is a particular, special, sacred realm. And we can perhaps call that realm a loka. We can perhaps call the realm of meditation samadhi loka, the realm of absorption, which we dedicate ourselves to having made the commitment to it. But that's meditation space is only sacred for as long as we stay in it. And we have a habit when we meditate of stepping out of the space, or letting ourselves step out of the space, or looking another way, letting things come into the space, letting the poison, letting the hindrances come into our space. And in the same way as we wouldn't allow muddy boots to enter the shrine room, we wouldn't want to let muddy boots enter our mind or our meditation, particularly if they're going to leave dirty imprints all over the place. So if the muddy boots come walking in, then turn around and walk out again, or just go walking through to the other side of the space, or just let them dissolve. And what we're doing, if we're doing that, we're centering ourselves in the present. And when we center ourselves in the present, we think of the space of meditation as presence. There are no poisons, there are no aversions, there are no craving, there's no puncture, no mental chatter going on. We're just present. And I think that idea of a space, the meditational space, is a presence where we're absorbed and where we offer no resistance. And that's when we're happiest, when we offer no resistance. But as Ramakrishna said earlier, there is a danger in thinking that meditating and thinking of it as a sort of passive activity. It's the opposite of virya. Virya is something we do actively, and meditation is something we do passively. Because our meditation can be inert if that happens. So we need some virya in our meditation. And we need to get a balance between effort and receptivity. Bhante talks, and I don't know if this comes from a sutta, but Bhante has talked about on the one hand, striving with determination, and on the other hand, looking on with equanimity. But if in meditation we look on with equanimity, we're looking on. Looking on is a volitional activity. It's not a passive one. And so we need appropriate effort when we meditate, but it's usually a fairly light touch sort of effort, a light touch sort of area. We're reading somewhere about blowing away the storylines, and perhaps that sort of blowing away is a gentle sort of virya that we need in meditation. And the spaciousness, talking about sort of antidotes, the spaciousness of the space can be an antidote, a counter to sort of any grasping or sense of attainment that we try and have when we meditate. Another phrase that we often hear is, don't believe everything you hear, or don't believe everything you read. I think also, don't believe everything you think. Yeah, there's things often coming out of my mind, oh, well, that's the truth, is it? No, it's just the sort of stuff that's coming and going. It's not always the truth. And another phrase I like from the Zen mind, beginner's mind, is the best way to perfect composure is to forget everything. And I like that sort of image as well. So we enter the space of meditation, and I don't want to, obviously we're not talking about physical space here, we don't want to reify something which is essentially dynamic. But when I talk of a space, it's not a bordered space, it's got the potential to be very much a borderless space, an expansive space, a space which can expand, because there's movement involved in it. There's movement from the everyday, from the mundane, into something that transcends that. And as I said earlier, we can see things and experience things in other ways. Let's look at the spiral path, and thank you again, Bhante, for bring in the positive nirvanas, perhaps a very little known teaching to the fore in your Dharma, your version of Dharma, the 12 positive nirvanas, the spiral path. And let's remember that after Samadhi, Samadhi gives way to the vision of things as they really are. Is that right? thank you. Oh, well, let's go to Ranagosha. And Bhante talks about this moment where we're going from Samadhi onto something else. And he talks about it in The Taste of Freedom. And he says, this is the point at which our most refined, our most blissful, our most beatific experience of the mundane or conditioned is succeeded by the first experience of the transcendental or unconditioned. So we're starting to get in touch, or we've got the potential to get in touch with a reality which goes beyond our present understanding. And this is what we undertake to realise on the spiritual path. This is perhaps what we undertake to realise when we meditate. And it's easy to get bogged down in the minutiae of everyday life, that little detail, so we can't see the wood for the trees. But meditation can help us to see the wood and the trees as one. And this is perhaps where the imagination comes in meditation. It's obvious in some form of meditations that imagination is always there. The metta-bhavana, we use imagination. The sixth element practice, we use imagination. Visualization practice, as we call it, of course we use imagination. But even in the mindfulness of breathing, we can use our imagination to think of, well, not my breath, but the breath that we share with others, the breath which is a universal breath, and to help us to put it in touch with others. And, you know, by using the imagination, we can come up with things of seeing ourselves as a ploughman or a ploughwoman, ploughing new furrows, or perhaps an explorer forging new paths through the jungle of our mind, or a construction engineer building new roads, or in the language of neuroscience, creating new neuro pathways. How does all this happen? Well, it happens through the mind. And of course, mind is the determining factor in Buddhism. And this is where I get to the title of the title of the talk. Because experience is led by mind, experience is preceded by mind, experience is led by mind, experience is produced by mind. The opening verses, of course, of the Dhammapada. Whatever good there is in the world, whatever evil comes from the mind. And through meditation, our mental states can become highly positive, and we can see our samadhi as a continuous flow of positive mental states. In the Ten Pillars, Bhante talks about meditation as raising consciousness by applying the four right efforts, by eradicating, preventing unhelpful negative mental states, unskillful mental states, and by cultivating and maintaining positive, helpful mental states, skillful mental states. And this we do in meditation. And it also says that what we meditate on, that we become, whether we meditate on love or the Buddha, or on peace, whatever we meditate on, we become. And he also says in the Ten Pillars that meditation is the subjective and direct method of raising the level of consciousness. If we want to raise our level of consciousness, there's a direct method through meditation. And so what the mind creates, mind can undo. And if the self, if the ego, is a mind-made construct, meditation can help us deconstruct that construct. So I've said that the meditation can be a borderless space. And as I said, when we meditate on the breath, it ceases to be our breath, but the breath. In a way, we can think of the meditation space not as my space, but as the space, as the some space, the universal space perhaps that we go to. And then the idea of a space can drop away altogether. And in the same way that there was a transition from going from our normal everyday life into meditation, there's also a transition when we go out of meditation. And we want to make that transition as smooth and as frictionless as possible. And often a period of just sitting is helpful to enable that to happen, where we can develop a reflective, a receptive attitude perhaps, and let go of whatever virya perhaps there was in our meditation, to let go of that and just to sit and reflect and be receptive as a way of transitioning out of meditation. But again, we can make a commitment, again we can make a resolution that the benefits, the fruits of our meditation will stay with us as much as they possibly can. And later in the day we can reflect sometimes on our meditation and try and get in touch with it again. Subhuti, in his papers on visualization workshop, talks about carrying the seed of the practice with you in your heart. So not only does it perfume the rest of your day, but it carries forward into your next meditation. So that your next meditation, if you like, carries the seed of the previous meditation. And I like that idea, because even though every meditation is unique, because it will arise according to certain conditions, different conditions, we can see a thread perhaps going through all our meditations, a seed that we've carried on, and something that stays with us. And in that way we can think of ourselves maintaining our purpose. And any positive experience that comes from the meditation, we want to try and stay with that as much as we can. The fruits of that meditation, the fruits that grow in the samadhi loka, perhaps we can just taste them sometimes during the day. So bridging the gap, we talk about bridging the gap between the cushion and everyday life, so that bridge becomes stronger. And hopefully our life will become more and more imbued with the effects of meditation. If we think of meditation as something sacred, we can live our life perhaps in awareness of that sacredness. In the first of the talks on the five spiritual faculties, Ratnakosha, in his keynote speech, talked about the five spiritual faculties as governing or controlling or dominating principles of our life. Well, how does that work with meditation? Well, if we practice thoroughly, we can embody our meditation. We can embody what Ratnakosha talked about, the power, the bala. We can embody the power of our meditation. So meditation can be seen not only as a discipline, but also as an expression of that embodiment. So what happens in meditation is a model for the rest of our spiritual life. And in fact, we can think here of Bhante's system of meditation, integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, receptivity, is also the model for his the five stages of spiritual life. So meditation is a model for the spiritual life. And if we practice faithfully and thoroughly, success is guaranteed. Or perhaps success is not the right word. Progress is guaranteed. And it's not random. It's not a matter of luck that we make progress. It's guaranteed by the principle of karma. So meditation is karmic. And of course, it's a bit of a paradox. Here I am sitting here spouting off about meditation, when meditation, of course, is something that we do. And when we do meditation, this is in the spirit of the Bodhisattva ideal, which is the spirit of our wonderful movement, we meditate not only for ourselves, but we meditate for the benefit of all beings, so that my becoming is your becoming, and your becoming is my becoming. So just to end on a quote from Bhante. In his reflections on going forth, he says that when we meditate, we go forth from our body, we go forth vertically into a higher state of consciousness, and we experience a kind of spiritual death. And he says, what is important is that we should become absorbed, at least from time to time, in the higher state, and be oblivious of everything else for at least a short time every day. This will give us inspiration, help renew our spiritual vision, and help us to live more in accordance with the Dharma. So thank you, Dad. Thank you, Bhante. Thank you. Mm-hmm.